Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
So I'm going to hog the floor first.
Hog it.
So first of all, thank you for my birthday present.
Oh,
so cool.
Next week.
You're so sweet. Yes, my birthday's coming up next week, but we got Mother's Day to get through. So we first off, let's say happy Mother's Day to all us hardworking dames out there.
Yes, yes, who deserve it.
Yes, the blood, sweat, and tears of motherhood. It's wonderful. Probably my favorite experience on the planet. You're too.
Yeah.
But anyway, this last weekend was Christopher's birthday. His actual birthday was yesterday, the big 6'5". Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to go to the mountains, so we went to Lake Arrowhead, and his daughter came up with her puppy, an Australian Shepherd. Oh, so cute. Her name is Penelope. Anyway, the funny story was, we were going to do a lot of hiking and being outdoors and maybe kayaking and all that stuff.
Right, sure.
So the first day was awesome on Friday. We definitely got a lot of walk around the lake, and it was just really nice. And then Saturday morning, we had a power outage. So I actually got Christopher to do yoga with me while we were doing yoga. All the power went out. But the power didn't just go out in our neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
The power went out in the whole Lake Arrowhead Village.
That's so amazing.
All the restaurants.
From the weather or just random?
I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
Maybe the wind or whatever. At that point, it wasn't snowing. But anyway, there was this big power outage and we couldn't go out to dinner at all. So the whole idea of taking him out to this nice restaurant, and all that wasn't going to happen. So guess who ended up cooking for 3 days?
But that's okay. Oh, you did?
I did. We made shrimp scampi. We had fun. And then Elise was great. Elise and Christopher did all the cleanup. So I got to make a mess in the kitchen. And it was fine. And then on Sunday, we got snowed in.
Unbelievable.
Came down. I think there was a foot of snow. It was so beautiful, but until they actually did the roads, I didn't have the kind of, I had tennis shoes and sandals, so
you just
walk outside, you get completely wet, so it was quite the adventure. It wasn't exactly as was planned, but we had a really good time. That was my weekend.
Amazing.
It was awesome.
So did you guys check the weather beforehand or no?
It was supposed to be 75 on Friday in the high 50s on the other days.
But no snow.
Not predicted like that. A little dusting
here
and there. But it was coming down in dumps.
That's amazing.
But it was so lovely to see snow in May.
Yeah, that is kind of cool.
Yeah,
really cool.
Fluffy, and it was a lot of it. It was amazing. And of course, the puppy loved
the
snow.
Oh, I'm sure.
So that was fun. So we got to take a walk later on when it sort of calm down a little bit.
Right.
But it was good.
Wow.
Played some silly games. Exploding kitten game. It's a card game. If you get the exploding kitten card, you lose.
Unless
you have a diffuser card.
Interesting. I love games. I'm all about this. And I'm very competitive.
I know you are.
I would not be able to get that kitten.
All right, honey. How about you? How was your...
I went to my son's gala for the school. It was on the CBS studio lot, which was so cool.
Did they have a silent auction?
Yes.
Did you buy anything?
You know what? I bid, but I was outbid. And I'm not competitive with that because
You don't know how to hover it and do just the fairy?
There are those bitches who do that. Who literally wait till the last minute and no, that wasn't me. I had a great time, though. It was probably one of my most favorite nights. It was really great.
Oh, fun.
Yeah,
and
it was
did
really
they feed
fun.
You?
Yes.
It was
they
a buffet?
Fed us. Yes, it was a buffet. It was a luau theme. So it was pokey or whatever that's called. Is that right? Pokey?
Pokey. Yeah.
The tuna or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it was just great. Really, really fun.
Did you wear a muumuu?
I wore a crop top and I did my Pilates all week for that.
You did?
Yes, I really did. I'm not kidding.
I'm very impressed.
I'll show you the pic.
Okay. I'm very impressed. Good for you.
So funny. So let's talk about last week.
Yes.
Okay, so we had Arlen Grad Gaines and Meredith Englander Polsky. They are the authors of I Have a Question About Death, a book for children with autism spectrum disorder. They're wonderful guests. I really, really love this book. And my son consistently talks about it. I mean, I should tell them this. He's asked me twice now, where's that book? Can we read it?
Oh.
So it's really had an impact on
him.
Does
London have the younger
I haven't read it to London, but I should. I mean, I'll probably wait one more year, but yeah, it's just a wonderful, really simple book. Answers questions about death for kids in any capacity. It's written for kids with special needs, but
it's valuable for anybody.
It really is. Yeah. I really feel like any kid can relate to this. It's really well done.
And any adult too. I mean, the concreteness of understanding it, just with real simplicity and honesty. I found it to be fabulous.
Yes. Fabulous. Agreed. Thank you so much for coming on the show, guys. And if you missed that, you can check us out on iTunes for that show.
And drum roll. Today, we have Dr. Daniel Keating, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. He received his PhD at Johns Hopkins. Keating has conducted research at leading North American universities, at Berlin's Max Planck Institute, and with the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, where he was a fellow for 2 decades and led the program in human development. He focuses on developmental differences, cognitive, social, emotional, and in physical and mental health. He resides in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome, Dr. Dan.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So it's so funny. My husband and brother both attended University of Michigan, and my husband's uniform daily, every single weekend, is a Michigan T-shirt. And all my friends
Blue.
Go Blue.
All my friends can attest. He wanted to get a tattoo of University of Michigan. Yes, that's how much he loves it. So I'll have to tell him.
So Dr. Dan's here today to talk to us about his book, Born Anxious, The Lifelong Impact of Early Life Adversity and How to Break the Cycle. I love that.
Yes.
I love that title and I love the book. I haven't gotten to read it from cover to cover, but I will for sure.
Well, thank you.
And I was reading a little bit of it, and I was just wondering if you could first kind of tell us a little bit about why that first year of life is so critical in a child's life, from your point of view.
Oh, sure. And this book, really focusing on that because of the particular area of human development, child development, that's of interest. And the particular focus is on what we've been calling stress dysregulation, which basically means that that's the period of time, really including the time in the womb as well. So from conception to the end of the first year of life appears to be, and a lot of evidence is supporting this, quite critical period that sets up how your stress response system is going to function. So whether it will be ideally, you know, sort of the a normal, we need a stress response system. It's we can't live without it. But ideally, it's one that has a daily rhythm that, you know, goes up in the morning and down during the day, and then falls at night so we can go to sleep. And then a reactive system that enables us to deal with imminent threats or issues that we all of a sudden have to deal with. During that period, as I mentioned, from conception through basically the first year of life, it gets set up, and a well-regulated stress system responds to threats, responds to issues, and then calms back down after a period of time and soothes out. The stress dysregulation that's a big focus in this book is where that has become dysregulated, particularly in the direction that it remains kind of on 24/7 alert. It's amped up, so when something happens, and it doesn't have to be a big thing, the system gets set off. It creates behavioral changes. It has long-term consequences for behavior and development. But it doesn't calm down very well. It's through an epigenetic process that we've really just begun to understand called methylation, which makes that stress system not function in the way that it should.
What is methylation? Can you say a little bit more?
So methylation is a type of this is getting into the public discourse gradually. And the particular part that we're talking about here is really around how social aspects get into how your genes function. So as we all know, our genes get their DNA right at the moment of conception, and that's what we have through the rest of our life, and it sets up a whole bunch of different things. Differences among us are to some extent due to that and so forth. But those genes, their job is to produce stuff, right? That's what a gene does. It produces chemicals that go through the body and does various kinds of things. Epigenetics is a method or a process biologically whereby it changes how that gene functions. It makes the gene behave in a particular way, and in this case, it essentially disables or makes it difficult to function for a particular gene whose job it is to tell us to calm down, stand down, the threat's gone, you can relax. And if that's turned off, you can think of it as a faucet that you can't quite turn off, but might just turn on randomly for all sorts of reasons that aren't very good reasons. And you can't turn that off. And the ultimate product there is that you've got lots of cortisol, the stress hormone, the fight or flight hormone, running through your body at a much more frequently, at higher levels, and harder to calm down from. So the methylation is, the way people are talking about it, which I think makes sense to me, is that it's the way that the genes can listen to the environment. It's what they pick up on. And they pick up on it because there's a lot of stress in that conception to first year of life period. In the womb, if there's a lot of free circulating cortisol because the mom is super stressed, then that can get in there and cause this methylation, this epigenetic change, altering how the stress system will function. Or during the first year of life, if for whatever reasons parents, caregivers are not able to provide the kind of nurturance that's needed, the infant will pick up on the fact that this is a high-stress situation and the same change can occur.
And does this have anything to do? I go to a holistic doctor, and she said I was a poor methylator. And so she recommended that I have extra folate, and that has helped my anxiety tremendously. Does this have anything to do with what you're talking about?
It does. I've not heard of that particular application of it, but we don't know enough about it to know for sure. It certainly could be. So folate, you're absolutely right. Folate is one of the chemicals that's necessary to build what are called methyl groups. So the methylation comes from the chemical notion of a methyl group, and a methyl group is basically a chemical compound that has this capability of changing the way our genes are functioning. Now, it can be, as this one would, as you've just suggested, it can be a positive or a negative. It depends on what gene is being operated. So a severe deficiency or a substantial deficiency in folate during pregnancy, and we all know that, you know, moms who are expecting or who think they might become expecting in the near future have been encouraged to take the, you know, folic acid supplements. And it's precisely to make sure there's enough there to have enough methyl groups around to be able to do things. And so some fairly serious disorders like, you know, spinal cord disorders, spina bifida and so forth, the mechanism is that is what the reason that a folate or a folic acid deficiency can lead to that is because it doesn't, the body's then not producing enough methylation, and certain things are needed to be methylated in order for development to proceed. So it's not methylation's bad or good or demethylation's bad or good. It depends on what the particular thing is that's supposed to happen at a particular point in time.
Yeah.
Wow. This stuff is so fascinating.
And I haven't heard this one. I'll have to look that up. That's really quite interesting. As a treatment for that, it sounds, you know, plausible to me. I don't know anything about it, but it definitely is chemically. There's a connection for sure. You know, whether, you know, how it works in this case, I don't know.
Right, unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah. So, what are the like the early childhood, the first year experiences that a child may go through that would really affect their ability to have a good stress regulation system?
Yeah. So basically what the big function here is one of is there adequate nurturance in a way that provides to the baby a sense that this is a relatively speaking safe and trustworthy place to be, right? So a lot of this started with animal work, of course, was where we first learned a lot more about this. There's now increasing evidence with human babies and so forth. And basically the idea is that the part that we consider that's relevant for this is not so much just, you know, nutrition and whatnot, though obviously that's important. But what we're really focused on here is the kind of parenting that creates a sense of things being okay. So, for example, the biggest one is going to be, is there a kind of warm, responsive parenting? And it doesn't have to come from the biological parent. Obviously, it can come from caregivers of any type. But where if something is wrong, the baby comes to understand that something's going to be done about it. So, for example, you know, we all know that babies, newborns are fussy, right, from time to time, and get distressed and are pretty, you know, can be pretty easily distressed. And they don't have much of a mechanism for bringing them back into a regulated sedated state, right, for calming themselves down. That has to be provided really by a caregiver. And so if they're distressed, and it can be for any reason, right, and all the parents out there who have done this with their kids when they were newborns will know exactly what I mean, so that you're the baby's distressed, you don't know for sure why, right? Maybe they need a diaper change. Maybe they're hungry. Maybe they just need to be touched. Maybe they need to be carried around. Maybe they need to be rocked. Whatever it is, you develop a routine, and each baby's a bit different, but you develop a routine, and that ideally, and most of the time, that will just kind of bring the baby back to a calm, soothing state, maybe to sleep or just a kind of, you know, alert, wakeful state that's relatively calm. If that's not around, they stay in that distressed state for a very long time. That being distressed, of course, physically means they're producing lots of cortisol. That extra cortisol can go around and say, hey, this is not a safe world. You'd better be on alert a lot of the time, because otherwise things could go badly for you. And the same thing, of course, when there's high cortisol in the womb, the baby's getting a signal from the environment, the fetus is getting a signal from the environment, in that case, that this is a dangerous world out there, there's problems. If you're going to survive, you'd better stay amped up and ready to respond all the time. If you, in fact, are in a highly dangerous world, as in, you know, back in the day, if you knew predators had come into where your troop lives, running away at the drop of a hat, you might save your life, right? So it's not a bad idea to do that. But in our kind of modern society, not that there aren't such places still, but in our modern society, it's more of a, it's less an adaptive mechanism and more of a of something that causes us risk for behavior later on.
Mm. It's interesting because my parents, obviously, they were kind of raised with spare the rod, spoil the child, and that was the parenting philosophy. So I know I did not get a lot of soothing as a young infant. And yet when my daughter was born, it was so beautiful. My pediatrician, he really put all that at ease for me, and he says, you can never spoil an infant. Mm-hmm. Don't ever even worry about that. You hold her, you rock her, you feed her, whatever she needs. Yeah. And that's not setting the stage for becoming a
dependent.
Spoiled.
Yeah.
Yes, no, because she doesn't have those capacities. It just helped to put my mind at ease. I think so many parents are given bad advice from previous generations about children, and you know, you have to be really strong to stand up to that and really check out
absolutely
things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that happens there, just that, you know, kind of that I think is really kind of interesting, is that if you think about what's going on biologically, right, so a lot of this story starts with kind of a biology that we've not seen before, that's kind of hidden from us until the recent research has gotten going. But essentially what we're you know, when you have that effect of bringing a baby from a distressed state to a calm, soothing state, right? Well, you know how good you feel when that happens, right? I mean, it's a great feeling, right?
Yes.
And it is for the baby too. Well, what's happening biologically, of course, is that there's a big rush of oxytocin, which counteracts cortisol, right? So you're learning that being close to other people, being connected to other people, not only feels good in the sense that you're making that connection with somebody at a personal level, it's changing your internal biology. It's giving you the means to control your own cortisol. And so you're learning how to do that early on from the very, very first days.
Mm. Wow. So interesting.
Yeah, I love when you can find the science behind
it. I love it too. Well, it's so funny because I remember when my younger son was probably, I don't know, he might have been 7 weeks. He was really young and I really wanted to go to the gym, and they had a little gym daycare. And so he was crying. And so after about, I don't know, 10 minutes, they called me down because that was kind of their rule. And I went down, and immediately as I held him, he stopped. Aww. And I remember the people, you know, looking around, they were like, oh my God, that's amazing. And I think, like, yeah, it's just like, it's the smell, it's the whole biology of of everything, of that,
the,
you know, calming down.
And it's also a great feeling, right?
Yeah, of course, exactly. Although I didn't get my workout in, but other than that, yes.
Well, sometimes it works easier than others, because I won't say which kids are which. They might eventually listen to this. But you know, sort of, some of them are like, you know, some of our, we have three kids. And, you know, sometimes kids can be very easily soothed, right? And they're very early, become regular sleepers through the night and so forth, right? And so you kind of relax and say, oh, that's really cool. And if you come to think that, hey, that's the way the world is, and then all of a sudden you have a baby who's bit of a different temperament, and it takes a whole lot more effort, but you still get there. It still feels great, but you have to understand that not every every kid is different from every other kid, obviously, and this is one of the dimensions. And one of the things that's, of course, problematic is that where you have a child who already has this stress dysregulation as an infant, right, because of something that happened to high stress for the mother, and unfortunately we're learning that we can have epigenetic inheritance too. You can actually inherit this pattern from a parent. Even though your DNA doesn't get affected, you can still inherit the epigenetic change. As a result, you can have an infant who's already stress dysregulated. Well, that's a real problem, because all of those things that we run through as parents to get things calmed down and to soothe typically are not working, or they're not working very well. And so we come to feel, oh, my goodness gracious, we're not doing a very good job. If it's a very, as a first-time parent, it's probably even worse. But essentially, it's like, oh, my goodness gracious, I can't get this child relaxed or soothed or calm. I must be doing something wrong, and it can go on and on. And that becomes a real challenge, because the only way you can turn this around in the first year of life, if it's already there, is by a kind of super nurturing, where you persist in that way beyond the level that you would normally expect to have to do. And you need help to do that. You can't do that 24/7 as a single parent. It's just not going to happen.
So what can you do for kids who you know have this and already have it? Like, is it too late? Is it like, oh, you got the gene and, you know, this is the way
it
is?
Yeah, you got that epigenetic change.
Yes.
It's never the case that you can't change things. Now, what you may not be able to change, and all the evidence tends to point to the fact that after about the first year of life or so, you can't change the underlying stress physiology, right? You've got that is the stress system that you have. But we have learned lots of things that enable us, really at any age, the shape of it and the nature of it changes a bit when we're talking about toddlers versus school kids versus teenagers versus adults and so forth. But the basics are the same. And the things that we've now come to understand, and I've already mentioned the biggest one in my view of them, is this notion of social connection. So you build strong social connections. For kids, resilience can often come from having some kind of a surrogate attachment figure, right? Mm-hmm. A mentor, a coach, a teacher, an extended family member who can provide that kind of, you know, reassuring social connection. And you build up, so it may not change your underlying stress physiology, but it helps you to mitigate the effects of that. You learn how to get positive neurohormones from social interactions, like oxytocin, and of course serotonin is the other one, the other big one. And you learn how to use that to be able to self-soothe, to calm yourself by maintaining strong or developing strong social connections. For an adolescent or young adult, it could be a romantic partner that brings that kind of thing to you, right? So social connection is definitely the biggest. The other one that's very strong and certainly is true for adults and adolescents, and increasingly we're finding ways to make it work for kids, is mindfulness, right? And we all know that mindfulness work is going along very well and is having lots of positive impacts. And that's a kind of, I think of that as a kind of a workaround. Your stress physiology may be the same, but you learn how not to let it activate you. You learn how to control it rather than have it control you. And the mindfulness where you're focusing as much as you can on the present, what's going on now, not becoming, you know, mired in regrets or resentments or worries about the past, not being overly focused on fear of the future, which is not to say we don't try to learn lessons from the past or take careful plans for the future, but just being dominated by them. That kind of mindfulness is another big one. And for adults, you know, a big one that really helps a whole lot is physical exercise. Is you burn off the cortisol. That's what, it's the fight or flight hormone. It's called that for a reason. The more you get that exercise and physiology geared up, it also has positive brain changes, as we now know, but it also kind of gets you out of that high stress, you know, agitated, annoyed, anxious, you know, feeling, hair trigger and so forth. It kind of smooths that right out on a physiological level. So those are three of the big ones that I think that we can think about. Those are, you know, I mean, what do you, I'm not sure I would use the word cure, but it's kind of like you can learn how to become a lifelong manager of your own stress system in a more positive direction.
So true. All the exercise thing. The day that I'm not going to be able to exercise, I don't know what I'm
going
to do. It's
I
such
know.
A regulator for me. But I was thinking, as you were talking, that kind of maybe we could go through like a real life situation, and you could give some advice about a scenario that comes to mind. Is you have a kid maybe who's not a good self regulator, and you get into a group of peers. Mm-hmm. who maybe are not so socially kind or so compassionate or attuned to this issue, and that they end up teasing the kid or rejecting the kid, and it almost can create like a negative feedback loop. So this wanting social connection, but then almost self-sabotaging because dysregulating and too much emotional drama and all that can turn some people off. So let's say a parent were to come to you with that issue with, let's say, their, you know, 10-year-old son, what would you recommend?
Sure. Well, I think it depends on the particular case, obviously, always does. But it is, I mean, I think one of the things is getting some awareness of what might be going on, right? So that in a sense, understanding that this child is not acting out in a way that's self-sabotaging because they're choosing to do that, or it can go the other way too. You can do the flight side, which is withdrawal, right? So they're just wanting to avoid social connections. It is critically difficult, certainly by around 10 when they're getting ready to launch into the teen years. You have to have social interaction to get socially skilled. There's just no other way for it. So a parent is right to be concerned about what it is that might be going on during that period of time. So one is the first step is a kind of an awareness. This is something that's your body is making you do X, right? Now, one of the things that being in a peer group that's particularly unkind or whatever, trying to find ways that you can make connections with individuals where you do have a positive, there are the opportunities for positive interactions, perhaps guided positive interactions. So, for example, depending on the severity of it, one of the things that turns out to work fairly well, and you know, a lot of this was initially, I think, begun to be worked out with kids who have autism, but it works for a variety of other things as well, is social skills groups, right, where you specifically bring kids together, and some of the kids are there as kind of volunteers who are very socially skilled to try to pull things together. Another thing you can do is to try to enlist teachers and people at the school in trying to make sure that there are opportunities for more positive interactions. And I think sometimes our inclination as parents is to be highly protective of our kids and go to the school and in a sense want to say, hey, you need to do this and it's your fault and so forth and so on. Whereas I think what we can figure out is their teachers are there a lot, right? They're observing things a lot and trying to encourage them to find some positive individual with whom your child could have a positive interaction, whether it's a collaborative project that they're working on and so forth, but to be attentive to that. And I think the other thing is to recognize is that you don't need, for this purpose, you don't need to have a big, huge group of friends. You don't need to have a lot of kids you're hanging around. One or two good friends, you know, or at least people that you can have positive interactions with, does essentially the same job. So I think part of it is learning certain specific social skills, and a lot of social skills groups will be teaching particular things, how to have a proper conversation, how to not act out, how to not take things the wrong way. Many of these kids have what we call a hostile attribution bias. That is, they will assume something that happened that's actually pretty neutral is actually meant as a disrespect to them or is negative to them. They overinterpret behavior as negative or hostile towards themselves. And trying to help them to do that, and even very simple things that a lot of the conduct disorder work is focused around, is some very concrete skills that keeps you from lashing out and getting yourself into deeper trouble. So the holding yourself and counting to 10, that does a lot for you physiologically. Among the other things it does for you behaviorally, you can't physically lash out at the other kids when that sort of thing happens. I think protecting them from particularly hostile groups and finding ways to subtly stage manage more positive interactions is also probably pretty important.
So we're talking with Daniel P. Keating. He's the author of Born Anxious. This is so interesting. Wow.
Maybe we can dive in a little bit on the social level, because I know that you do say some really important things about the rising inequality as a major cause of current stress epidemic. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So, and it's interesting because this is the stress epidemic I'd heard of and so forth, but I was not, until I actually started writing the book, I was not as aware of the stuff that's going on there. I think we're becoming all, just in our everyday lives more aware of this. So basically the stress epidemic is one where we're looking at patterns over now, we're talking about 30-year patterns, sometimes 40-year patterns, where several things are going on that say that we've got a stress epidemic going on. At the most extreme level, where we look at various kinds of stress-related diseases and disorders, where we're looking at things like metabolic diseases or obesity, some kinds of heart diseases, sleep problems. A lot of those are clearly stress-related. For a number of them, we've seen increases over the last 30 years or so using data from the Center for Disease Control, increases of 20 to 25%. So that's one indicator. Another indicator is where people have done population surveys saying, how stressed do you feel? That has gone up a substantial amount over that same period of time. And it's not, obviously, they're just saying they feel more stressed. They must be more stressed because they're seeing more stress-related diseases coming online. And then a final one that came out after the book, but it's a really interesting piece of work where people looked at, there are various kinds of indicators, physiological indicators that you have high stress levels. And these are things like cholesterol or things that have to do with kidney function or liver function and so forth. And because we've got some national databases where that sort of stuff has been collected, these folks were able to put together what they called a physical stress load index. How many of these things are circulating in your body that if they're there long enough will probably lead to some kind of an illness? And what they found is that that has also increased. Those precursors, physical precursors of later illness, have also increased substantially over from the late 1970s until their most recent database, I think, was 2009 to 2014. So that's gone up as well. What we also see in that is that the inequality in that has gone up. We see that it's much higher, the increase has been much higher for people in the lower end. We might expect that, you know, if things are becoming unequal, you've got material resources, things like, you know, to worry about, you know, housing and food and so forth. But the middle class is showing slightly less, but still quite elevated. And even in the upper middle class, we're seeing a substantial rise, not as much as the middle class or you know, the economically disadvantaged folks, but we still see it there. I think that the reason, I think to understand why, and I've talked about in the book, I talk about inequality as the new predator. We don't have a tiger in the bush, but we've got a lot of worries about inequality. Mm-hmm. If you're at the lower end on the socioeconomic scale, you know why you're stressed, right? It's like, are you going to lose your job? Are you going to lose your home? Do you have enough food security to take care of your kids and so forth? Mm-hmm. Highly stressful, obviously. But for the middle class or even the upper middle class, we'd say, well, what is it that they're so stressed about? Why would inequality bother them? Well, I think what we see is that social mobility is going down. Things can happen pretty quickly. The more unequal you are, the society is, the faster you fear that you could slide back down. Mm-hmm. And so that you're worried about that. If not for yourselves, you're certainly worried about it for your kids. Are they going to have the kind of life that I had? And social mobility has gone down as well. And then the final piece to the puzzle is we can look at comparisons, not just over within the U.S. over time. We can look at how the U.S. compares to other countries. And many other countries have much less inequality in a variety of ways, and they, in fact, do better in health, and they, in fact, do better in longevity. You live longer in a more equal society. And so those are the factors that go in that make me very concerned, because the more of that stress you've got going around, and I think inequality is a big motor of that, the more you've got stressed-out expectant moms, the more you've got stressed-out new parents who then may wind up in embedding that kind of a difficult stress system in the kids. And so you have this kind of vicious cycle that can go around and around unless we start to do something about it.
This is so fascinating. Wow. Do you have some thoughts on how, like, people like Kelly, me, and our listeners could be helpful in pointing that awareness out to more people? Because I don't think a lot of people think about it that way.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, we can talk about things like social connection and physical exercise and mindfulness, which are fabulous. But if you're not aware of the fact that you've got something to deal with, or a loved one has that kind of issue to deal with, you're more likely to ascribe, the wrong interpretation to what's going on. It's like, well, it's not that this coworker's so stressed out, you know, they don't know how to handle stress and that's causing them this. We're just going to think they're a schmuck, right? I mean, you know, why are they being this way towards me, right? And you can't necessarily expect to change other people all that much. But if it's a loved one, you might say, you know, are you aware that when something happens, this is the kind of reaction? Maybe that's not something that's, you know, about you as a person. That's more about the way that your system works that causes this. Is that something we could talk about? Is it something maybe we could find a way to get some help for? So I do think that awareness is a, in a sense, it's the key that unlocks the toolbox that then opens up all the kinds of tools that we could get to if we knew that it was a good idea to try to see what's in that toolbox.
And I'm curious your take on technology and increased stress. Have you looked at any of those
studies?
Yeah.
I think it's a potential stress increaser in a lot of ways, and I mean I'm not of the persuasion that everything about new technology is bad and causing horrible things to us, but I do think that we have not yet figured out how to use a lot of the new technology to our best advantage. I mean, there are a lot of kind of obvious ones for teens, the potential for sort of cyberbullying and social difficulties is, I think, definitely enhanced if you've got that kind of situation going on and you're one of the folks that people are pointing at. It's not like just something that happens to you at school. It's available or imposed on you 24/7. So there's that kind of issue. On the other hand, there is research that says that it is, participation in social media is beneficial, particularly for some kids that have a little bit of difficulty, shyness or maybe a bit introverted or whatever. Not that that's a bad thing to have, but it may be that they want to get out more, and this is an easier way of trying to maintain kind of connections in ways that are more, comfortable for them to do. I think there are a bunch of them. I could go on and on. But one that I think is particularly relevant is the fact that we're so wedded to our devices that it's hard to set them aside. It's hard to set them aside, to have a good family dinner time, right? Mm-hmm. So that you actually interact, learn the skills of interacting face-to-face, which are more challenging in many ways than social media. And the other thing that a bad habit that many of us have, and I confess to being in this group, and try to control it, is checking that email late at night, looking at what's going on and being on, social media and whatever. The thing that happens there is that almost never calms you down, almost always ramps up your cortisol, which interferes with your sleep. Mm-hmm. And interfering with your sleep is a sure way to get your stress system out of whack, because sleep, of course, is an important component to all of these things. And as I say, it's a kind of a cycle. Sleep deficit leads to more stress leads to sleep deficit. And I think that technologies can definitely, have some very unfortunate effects in that domain as well.
Mm-hmm. What time do you turn your phone off, Kelly?
I turn mine. You're going to be very impressed, actually.
7.
I do. Yeah.
7 o'clock?
Good for you.
Yeah. I turn my ringer off at 7. Well, I mean, I'm also putting my young ones to bed, but
well, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But at that point, I feel like, that is my day is done. I am under no more obligation to anybody, and whatever's, super important, I'll get in the morning. Yeah. What about you? You probably are a late bird, aren't you?
I suck.
You probably turn it off.
Well, I actually am really working hard at not looking at anything after 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at the latest,
which is still good.
Because I have a fair amount of high crisis people in my practice, and in the old days we used to have pagers, right?
Yeah.
I don't have a pager anymore, so and I don't have a landline, so
right.
So, but I mean, we do our duty by letting people know if it's an emergency, they call 911. We're not a 24-hour emergency clinic anyway.
Yeah.
But sometimes I feel the sense of, oh, if somebody's in distress late at night, they're going to have trouble sleeping. If I can be helpful, I'll be helpful.
Yeah.
But I'm making a much stronger commitment, because Dr. Dan, my sleep sucks, and as you're talking I can say, oh, there it is, I get too revved up late at night, don't sleep well, I'm more challenged the next day. So that's really good. I'm glad you highlighted that, because it does make me more mindful of that. I really need to stay with that commitment.
And there's this really interesting research, and I'd want to see it replicated before I completely believe it, but it seemed very persuasive to me, the little that I have seen about it, is that one of the things that's most likely to happen in that circumstance is you're hardly ever going to get deeply engaged in good news, right? I mean, you're always going to be, it's like, oh, that email that I didn't reply to, or that crisis at work that I have coming with me, or, a client that I'm having particular trouble with. The research essentially is saying that when we have those thoughts that are tagged with negative emotions, sort of concern, anxiety, anger, worry, whatever it is, those unfortunately are the ones that we tend to encode more in our brain with sleep. Like, sleep encodes lots of things. Mm-hmm. If we go to bed with negative emotions and so forth, those are the things that are more likely to get encoded into our brain. Mm-hmm. And that just is like, oh, wait a second, do you really want to have that in your mind, when you're about to fall asleep? So in addition to the screen keeping you up and your cortisol keeping you up, you're going to go to sleep, and what's going to get encoded is not very good stuff sometimes.
Mm-hmm. that explains the
exactly.
the dreams.
It's so true.
Where did all that anxiety come yeah. from?
Right, and the waking up with worry, right? It's like if you go to bed with a worry, most often you're going to wake up with that worry, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's going to, if you're waking before your normal time to wake up, is going to be that thing that pops up. It's like that's what's like, you know, triggering, oh, I should wake up and worry about this. Not that you can do anything about it in the middle of the night, but you know what I mean? It's kind of, that's what wakes you up.
For sure. I found these really cool YouTube videos, though. They're 8 hour and they're called Deep Sleep. And you just put that on in the background.
Oh, interesting.
And I have been sleeping a little better.
Is it like
alpha? Really?
Yeah,
waves? I don't know about
something
those.
To appeal to the different brain waves.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
To keep you, and it's like, it's a constant. And it doesn't, I mean, the only thing is sometimes I have to put a towel over the television screen.
Oh, right.
The light
can
be kind of distracting. But yeah, it's been kind of interesting.
So I'm
another one that we find works sometimes with our kids, and I know it's not supposed to be the way you're supposed to do it, the mindfulness apps where you're supposed to be alert and mindful and so forth, but if you're sleeping and you put on a mindfulness app and you keep listening to it, it does at least, you know, it works and get you to sleep.
Yes.
At least it works for our kids sometimes. So
I could see that. So I want to change topics for one quick second. I do have a question about a stressful birth. Can that have an impact on an infant? Like, just, you know, like a emergency C-section, or, you know, the mother's heart rate going down and she gets stressed. Like, how much does the birth impact the infant with this stress hormones?
Right. So I think it does, but not through this particular mechanism so far as we know, or at least so far as I know at this point in time. So basically, when you have like an immediate stressful thing that you might even think about as like a birth trauma of some sort, right? Something that's like pretty dramatic and kind of hitting all at once, that tends to create a different set of a physiological cascade than the one that we're focusing on here. So stress dysregulation is more like a something that goes on for some period of time where you're keeping to get the signal about what's going on. Interestingly, what happens with that, or, you know, sort of something even a bit later, and, you know, in the first year or whatever, where it's a fairly strong kind of thing but tends to be more time constrained, like a PTSD kind of thing, is that it does have an effect on your stress system, but not so much on this amped up. It tends actually to blunt your cortisol system. It tends to have an effect whereby that normal rhythm where you kind of like it builds overnight and reaches a peak and you wake up alert and ready to do stuff, and then it gradually goes down during the day. There's another little bump usually in the late afternoon, then it takes you down towards sleep. It kind of goes flat. And so what you get is, instead of being a hyper-responsive, hyper-reactive individual, it tends to go in the other direction of kind of hypo-reactivity, so that you're not engaging much at all, right? So that you're kind of, you know, kind of slowing down. That seems to be associated, and I think I don't want to overclaim where the evidence is on this point, but that seems to be a different kind of pattern than what we've talked about in other cases, kind of the steady drip of everyday life. Here you're talking about a short, sharp, dramatic kind of thing, and that does affect the stress system, but it appears to do so in a somewhat different way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So give our listeners some ideas about how we can increase resiliency in our children.
Sure. Well, I think we've kind of mentioned some of the big ones. I think the social connection is by far the biggest one. So I don't know if you're familiar with a book that my friend and colleague Ann Mastin did a couple years back called Ordinary Magic, and she's someone that studied resilience for quite a long time, looking at resilience in this case defined as kids who clearly had some kind of early adversity, often socioeconomic, but other kinds of adversity early on, and then turned out to function, you know, quite well. One common factor that runs through her studies and other studies, like Emmy Werner's old study on Against the Odds and so forth, have been really focused on finding one really good, strong social connection, like a surrogate attachment kind of thing, where you can draw on, you know, those good social neurohormones that I talked about, but also begin to develop a kind of a trust in the other that might not have happened in infancy, that might have left you with an insecure attachment, that in effect you begin to believe that the world is going to be a place that can be safe, at least under many circumstances. So I think that's one of the big resilience factors that we would tend to look at. And the other, in terms of more everyday resilience and being able to bounce back and that sort of thing, is a kind of, you know, it's the kind of parenting that we've talked about a lot of times in the field, and there's a lot of research on, called authoritative parenting, where you maintain that warm, sensitive, contingent connection with them that's so crucial in infancy, but you begin to have some boundaries and expectations and encouragement that, yes, you can do this. There are things that you can achieve. You can stick to it. You know, I think not so very different from, you know, from the notion of grit that's out there in the work of Duckworth and others. And so looking at those things as things that you can succeed if you persist. And I do want to put a little note in here is I love the concept of resilience. I think it's so important, and I think we need to find ways to do this. I was talking with a principal who was very conscious of this, and it was a school for kids who had troublesome, this is a kind of an alternative high school for kids who had trouble with the law or other kinds of situations. And he was saying, you know, what we really strive for here is to try to create a culture of resilience where everybody, all the staff, all the faculty, but all the staff are really concerned about the kids, and you convince them that they matter to you and that they matter in the world. So that kind of thing is really important. The little thing I want to make sure that we don't go overboard, and sometimes we do, is that we can say, oh, well, resilience is something that's, you know, you can acquire, you can become resilient, and that is true, but on the other hand, we shouldn't say, oh, it's okay if we give you a bum early start. If you don't become resilient, that's your problem, right? So I don't want to push us over in the direction of saying, oh, it's easy to do and everybody should just do it. If it were easy to do, we wouldn't have any of the difficulties, right? Sure. But I do think we need to understand that it is an achievement. It is something that we need to work on, but it is achievable. But typically it's going to require some help from concerned adults and concerned other people who are going to, you know, be there for you.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So can you give us a very simple, mindful exercise that we can kind of leave everybody with?
Yeah.
Just a really quick one.
Yeah, well, I would say that I'm a big fan of some of the apps that are out there. I don't want to advertise particular ones because I don't know all of them. I'm sure they're very good ones, but I think the one that I would say that comes back to our earlier conversation is that using our mindfulness to not fall into rumination late at night, to not fall into a sense of regretting things or resenting things or carrying around a bunch of things. That rumination thing, one of the areas I study is adolescence, and one of the things that I see, you know, that the research is showing us a fair bit, we know that depression increases quite sharply right around puberty and just after that, and particularly so for girls at probably a 3-to-1 or more ratio compared to boys. And I think a big driver of that is that you're able to ruminate. You think about all the things that could have gone wrong, that went wrong during the day, and what does it mean, and how am I doing it? You're ruining your sleep, you're rising your cortisol, you're giving yourself bad memories that you're going to sleep on and come back to in the morning. And so the mindfulness that says, no, wait a minute, stay in the present. What's the present thing here? What I need to do is to think about trying to figure out how I can get myself soothed out, thinking about the kinds of things that are just straightforward, and get myself into that good sleep state. I would say that we often think about mindfulness as something that's, oh, you know, it's meditation, it's when we get up in the morning, it sets up our day, but it's also something that's a good counteraction to that kind of rumination that can, particularly it's problematic for adolescents who don't have other skills maybe to deal with it, but I think it's important for everybody.
I love that too. And one of my favorite mottos for myself is like, everything is okay in this moment.
Sure.
Because so much of our anxiety is in the future. And so it's like, if you just take it moment by moment, like, I'm okay in this moment, it's really helpful.
Absolutely.
Well, and if we don't do that, it's often, you know, in addition to the rumination, it's so easy to catastrophize. It's so easy to say, oh, things are completely awful, right? And if your stress is regulated, that's easier than ever to fall into, right? Because that stress feeds on itself, the cortisol feeds on itself. And pretty sure it's not, oh, you know, my boss is going to be annoyed that I didn't get that email out today. Rather than that, it's going to be, oh, my God, the organization is going to fail. It's going to blame friends are going to be out of work because I didn't do that email, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to get there with that constant rumination. And if you just say, everything's cool, there's nothing that can't wait till the morning, I can take care of it then.
Beautiful. And Dr. Daniel Keating, we must say goodbye. Our time is up.
But
this
tell
is
us
so informative. Tell us where people can find you in the book.
Oh, sort of everywhere. I mean, I think it's still actually on the new release thing at Barnes & Noble, if that happens to be one of the places you shop, but it's also available, of course, on Amazon through St. Martin's Press, and there that has a list of all the places that you can buy it from online, and I'm hoping it'll be out in the bookstores even past the new release period. So it's but Amazon for sure is easy to order from.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Fabulous
book. Fantastic book and a fantastic guest.
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So, boy, that went so fast.
So fast.
Hundreds of more questions. Anyway, very exciting. That was an awesome show. And we have next week, we have Dr. Beth Leadham. She is a colleague psychologist mine. And she's going to come in and talk to us about sex addiction.
And polygamy.
Polyamory.
Oh, polyamory. Yes. I was like, which one?
Polygamy is illegal, at least here. So
yes.
We probably won't talk about that.
Exactly.
Much,
I knew it was something.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody have a beautiful week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.